everybody. It's a real pleasure to have Celine after some time here. I don't have a look at the list of participants, so maybe for most of them, Celine is well known. But anyway, as usual, I am introducing the speaker for people who. For new people, well, Celine did the PhD in the University of Cambridge, UK. Then she spent 2 years as a Marie Curie fellow at the Observatory of Trieste. Then she moved as a fellow at ESO Garching. And then she got a CNRS position at LAM. Where she worked until 2016 or 18, and don't remember. Let me check. Anyway, never mind. 2018, when she moved to Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching as a Humboldt Fellow. Since those, so she is on leave from CNRS, and since 2019, she is a project scientist of a high risk for ELT at ESO. And the talk today is based on a review that she recently wrote with the Hook on cosmic metal and dust cycles. Celine, it's up to you. 30 minutes, relaxed.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot, Carlo. Thanks, everyone. It's a great pleasure to see many familiar faces and names here. Yes, indeed, as Carlo has nicely mentioned, I'm currently delegated from CNRS Marseille to ESO, where I'm a project scientist for HIRES, which is the high-resolution spectrograph for the Extremely Large Telescope. And the work I'm going to talk about today is related to a review that we've published in the annual review looking at the cosmic metal and dust cycles. So just to get started, I'd like to highlight one aspect, which is that many of us are really busy, you know, trying to understand both dark energy and dark matter that are clearly, you know, the biggest constituent of the universe. But I'd like to stress that even the so-called normal matter is poorly understood. In fact, only 10% of the baryons, you know, the normal matter, is coming from light, from stars. And the remaining 90% is made of intergalactic gas that is difficult to probe in emission. So this is the topic of this talk here, to concentrate on that 90% of the baryons. So the picture we've been building over the years is this one. This is an illustration from TNG-50 cosmological simulations, where a galaxy accretes its gas from the cosmic web, which then cool down through lamina variegation to become first atomic and then molecular, and then will form stars in its centers, and will drive supernovae winds and AGN driven winds that will in turn expel gas and metals and energy out of galaxies. And here in blue coding is the metallicity map in this galaxy. And this is the result of this gas moving in and out with radial velocity of the order of 100 kilometers per second that is causing this so-called baryon cycle that is taking place in the halo of galaxies. This is the light emitted by stars in the same object, and you see how little of these full processes we capture by concentrating on just starlight. All physical processes take place in halos around galaxies that we often call the circumgalactic medium. So just let me highlight some of what we've learned over the years about the gas from both atomic and molecular phase. So again, I'm showing both results from observations and simulations. And this is now in the center, a galaxy that is a Milky Way light. I mean, it's a redshift 2 galaxy that is going to evolve into a Milky Way at redshift 0. And I have color-coded the different phase of a gas according to the so-called Coulomb density, which is the number of atoms per surface area per square centimeters. And we have on the bottom or top, sorry, left, the Coulomb density distribution, that's the number of objects with a given Coulomb for both H1 atomic gas and H2 molecular gas. And we see that there are fewer larger H1 systems, and above the Coulomb density, molecular gas is overtaking. The top right panel relates the Coulomb density to the volumic density of the gas for these different ionization states. And the bottom right panel shows the neutral fraction as a function of density. So again, you know, the larger the Coulomb density, the more neutral the gas is, and the higher the density. And the bottom left panel shows the distribution of H1 and H2, you know, from starting from a galaxy in some of these TNG simulations that I've mentioned earlier. And you see that H2 molecular gas only dominates in the very center, but H1 reach further radius with lower Coulomb density. So the more central, the more neutral is the gas. And as we move out, the gas slowly becomes more ionized. Another question is, how can we probe this gas? So in observation, what we do is we use so-called absorption lines, which is a technique that makes use of a bright background source, such as a quasar, to study in absorption the properties of a gas along the line of sight to the observer. So in this example here, I'm showing a quasar spectrum from recording with UVS and VLT with a very high signal-to-noise ratio. The emission lines are intrinsic to the quasar, and the many absorption lines are related to the observers. And blue words of Laman alpha is all the H1 observers, some of which are associated with metal lines. So this technique is very powerful for several reasons. First, we probe the gas down to very low Coulomb density, and the sensitivity of the technique is independent of redshift. It depends on how bright is the background source. So potentially we can do that up to the highest redshift. And also we have direct access to information on the physical properties, temperature, etc. So I'm going to start by posing a question, which is, how does the gas reservoir which fuels star formation evolve? And I'm going to start with this very well-known plot from Madder and Dickinson that is showing the star formation rate as a function of redshift. I'm having an issue with changing slides. Do you see that?
No, in my case, I still see the question.
Yes, I'm trying to move to the next slide, but it's not. Here we are. Thank you.
No, it's good. Here we are.
Yes. So I'm sure you're very familiar with this plot, which is just looking at essentially the amount of star that is being formed in units of cosmological volume. And so we have a quantity that increases from very high redshift to redshift 2, which is what we call the epoch of galaxy assembly, that stays high up to redshift 1, and then that decreases, quite dramatically by several orders of magnitudes to today. Now, of course, the naive picture is that, the more stars we are forming as cosmic time goes, the higher this quantity should go, but that's not what is being observed at the lowest redshift. And so one of the main questions of galaxy evolution today is to understand what are the physical processes that drive this decrease from redshift 2 to redshift 0. And so to tackle this question, I'd like to start first looking at the H1 atomic gas. And here I'm plotting a quantity that I'm going to show again and again, which is the cosmic evolution of mass density in units of solar masses per cubic megaparsec on the y-axis right, divided by the critical density at redshift zero. That's just a normalization. And the y-left axis shows the unitless omega mass density quantity. So these different gray bars here are H1 measurements at redshift greater than 1.5 from these quasar absorbers that I've just introduced at lower redshift zero from 21 centimeter radio observations of galaxies. And I think what we can take away from these results is that H1 evolution is well constrained. It decreased mildly by a factor 2.5 from redshift 5 to today. And I'm showing here a very simple fit to this quantity that has no more physical ground to it than being linear. And in the inset, I'm showing the rate of change between the amount of H1 gas at redshift 5, shown in green, and a given redshift, and the rate of change in the amount of mass in stars, shown in pink. And what we see immediately is that the H1 evolution with cosmic times is not as fast as the speed at which we are making stars. So let me put this into somewhat broader context. One step I've described that is not shown here is how we go from the atomic H1 gas to the molecular H2 gas, which is the fuel for the star formation. And in recent years, there's been tremendous new results coming from mostly ALMA, but also VLA and IRAM, showing measuring the same omega, the same mass density, but for molecular gas. So this is very challenging measurement to make because essentially ALMA, for example, is intrinsically not a survey instrument because of a small primary beams that make it very prone to cosmic variance. I'm showing here a variety of results, including absorption techniques shown as upper limits from the ALMACA project. So ALMACA is making use of all the calibration data from ALMA to make science. And it's still early days, but there is very little evolution in this quantity except a possible turnover from redshift 1 to lower redshift. Of course, I'd like to highlight the upcoming work from APEX Concerto project, which is going to look at intensity mapping of C2 to probe some of these quantities, which I think is very exciting. So let me put this together. We know very well the total amount of variance, which is shown here as a blue horizontal line. We know this from CMB anisotropy from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And most of these variants are in the ionized gas, right? Now, if we focus on what I would call the condensed matter, which is the cold gas, both atomic and molecular, and stars, here's a picture we have today. So again, the green is this neutral gas that I was showing earlier. The gray here is molecular gas. So again, you know, larger bars, early days. I think this quantity is bound to be measured better in the coming years. And the stars is essentially the amount of mass in stars. So what we see already from this plot is at any redshift, the amount of H1 gas dominates over H2, right? There is more atomic gas in the universe at any redshift than molecular gas. I think that's very important. I think H1 is well measured. H2 actually current shape mirrors quite nicely the star formation rate history. So this is now another way of showing the same information that maybe is a bit more complex. So let me slowly walk you through this. This is a cumulative plot now. So I'm adding up on each of these components that I'm collectively calling condensed matter, adding up from molecular gas, neutral, and stars. And The black dashed line shows the cumulative density at redshift 6. So constant condensed matter would be flat, as this line is. And what we see is at high redshift, H1 is decreasing as H2 is being made. But at lower redshift, there are more stars being formed than gas being consumed, right? So the next question we want to answer then is how do these baryons cycle through those different phases, right? So one way to look at this is to compute the depletion time scales, which is essentially the amount of gas divided by the rate at which I'm forming stars in a given system, or here in this approach, globally in the universe, right? So I'm agnostic about which type of galaxy I measure H1, H2, or star formation in. And in fact, they may not be the same objects, but I'm looking at the global H1 content and global molecular content and the global star formation rate. And so the green here is showing the cold gas, so H1 plus H2 gas depletion timescale. And the gray is looking at the molecular gas depletion timescale. The black dotted line is measurement of molecular gas depletion timescale in targeted IRAM surveys of massive galaxies. And in fact, the results are consistent with our work, with, you know, globally a timescale, a depletion timescale of 1 gigayear. Which is quite constant over a large cosmic time. So essentially, there is something quite universal in the rate in which galaxies convert their gas into stars. Now, one can use this observable to infer how much gas needs to fall into the system to explain the observed rate at which stars are being formed. And this is exactly what's shown here. So the purple line here is the rate density that we need to have gas coming into the system to explain the observation of the SFR. And I think it's interesting to compare this accretion with the black line above, which is the halo baryon accretion, which can be scaled to a 4% efficiency and then look like this dotted line, which have, you know, has a remarkable similar shape as the net matter accretion that we've just derived. So let me emphasize what I mean here. So this is the amount of gas that is moving in, both physically, you know, due to motion, but also, you know, changing phase, right? So it's the transformation of gas from ionized IgM into neutral H1 and molecular H2, and then eventually stars, right? I'd like to stress that this simple computation is actually consistent with the so-called BAF tube or regulator model. That's a very, I think, simple view on galaxy formation that states that there is an equilibrium between inflow, outflow, and star formation. So at early time, there is gas accumulation, and star formation is limited by how much gas is available. But at later time, the galaxies reach a steady state in which the star formation is regulated by the net accretion rate. And this is supported by our findings here. So the next question I'm going to ask is, which baryonic components of the universe host the metals? So as you know, by metals here, we speak broadly about any elements that are not hydrogen or helium. And I'd like to remind everyone that some 20 years ago, there was an accounting of the metals in the universe that show there was a shortfall of metals between the expected amount of metals from integrating the star formation rate history and adding all the known components of metals in the universe. And I think it's interesting to review that, two-decade-old problem. But before I move there, let me focus a bit about how are metals distributed around galaxies. And I'm showing again here a typical TNG50 galaxy that is radiated edge-on And I'm showing on the left the gas metallicity, where zero is solar metallicity, minus one is a tenth solar. And I'm showing this as a function of the azimuthal angle, which is the angle from the major axis of the galaxy upwards. To the right is the gas radial velocity, where green is gas moving in and red gas moving out. And clearly in that example, the distribution of a gas is not uniform with azimuthal angle, and hence the metallicity distribution of a gas is not. And we can look at this statistically, which we have done both TNG50 and Eagle. And I'm plotting here again the gas metallicity as a function of azimuthal angle. And there is a trend where the gas is more metal poor along the major axis where accretion is taking place, and the gas is more metal rich along the minor axis. And the reason why we focus on this quantity is those are observable quantities that can be derived from current observations. Now, I'd like to stress that if you remember the movie I showed at the start, those physical processes of gas, you know, moving in, out, and falling back, or escaping the potential well of the galaxy is very complex. What we show here is the net result of these many processes is a signature of the metallicity distribution with azimuthal angle. And I think these results are remarkable because remember, TNG and Eagle are very different simulations, both in numerical and physical processes that are implemented, and yet both, and you know, show the same trend in these results. But let's look at more global quantities. So again, one can use those quasar observers to measure the amount of metal in the neutral gas. We have, however, to make a correction for dust depletion. So some of the metals are locked onto dust grains, and we can use multi-element empirical methods to correct for this, which is done in this plot here. So again, this is gas metallicity as a function of redshift, solar metallicity zero, a tenth solar metallicity is minus one, a hundredth solar is minus two, etc. The individual data points are a statistical sample of DLAs, and the black arrow bar are H1-weighted gas metallicities. So again, very little evolution, about one deck over 10 giga-year. The scatter in the individual points is larger than the evolution in the mean. But importantly, there is a flaw in the amount of metals found in this gas, right? I've traced here the current limits in UV and optical observations that show that we could detect gas that is more metal poor, but in this statistical sample, we do not find it. So a pristine gas is extremely rare. So again, we can use these metallicity measurements to compute the metal mass density. I'm showing here in green for the highest column density, in purple for partly ionized gas, and in blue for the ionized gas. And we can now compare this to the expected amount of metals, which is integrating the star formation rate density, right? And I'd like to stress that this computation is independent of the IMF, because essentially massive stars dominate the metal production. And what we see right away is that most of the metals at redshift 3 to 4 are found in this neutral gas, but there is a shortfall at lower redshifts. In fact, we need to account for other components, which I'm showing here. In purple or pink are the amount of metals in stars, which is a measure of 2.7, redshift 0.7 today, but I guess we will be able to measure this quantity at higher redshift. And in yellow here is the amount of metal in the hot gas, right? So in inter-cluster medium and intra-group medium. And again, you know, current measurements are limited to 0.7, but hopefully, you know, Athena or other experiments may help us measure these quantities at higher redshift. So the question I started with is there a missing metal problem? Here I'm showing 4π diagram of the census of metals in four different redshifts, starting from 4.5, where most of the metals are found in the neutral gas. At redshift 3, accounting for some of the metals in the ionized gas, you know, almost close the metal budgets. At low redshift, there are more constituents, you know, taking part into this metal budget. Most, you know, half of the metals are found in stars. A good fraction is also in the hot gas. And I think, you know, those kind of measurements are lacking at redshift 1.5, but if we were able to make those measurements at medium redshift, I expect that mostly the metal budget would be closed. So today, I think we have little evidence to this missing metals problem. So I'd like shortly, perhaps, to say a few words about dust. So I've explained how we've used empirical methods to derive a dust depletion. Of course, we can then turn the calculation around and estimate from this DLA measurements the quantity of dust that is being measured in the neutral phase. So this is what's shown here. I'm going to perhaps go a bit quickly on this result. This is the dust to gas ratio on the top as a function of metallicity for different redshifts. And to the bottom is the dust to metal ratio. So a few things I'd like to stress is those measurements retrieve the redshift zero measurements that are shown here in black dotted and dashed lines, but they extend to lower metallicity. And of course, we can look at a redshift evolution of those quantities, which was not possible before. So I think there is a lot to explore here. Another way of looking at this is this dust to gas ratio as a function of redshift. Again, for individual measurements in pink and for weighted H1 weighted measurements in black error bars. Interestingly, I think we can compute then the dust mass density, which is shown here for the neutral gas, up to the highest redshift, right? So we can now constrain this quantity up to redshift 5 or 5.5. And we can compare this with measurements from the Sloan spectra, quasar spectra, using both extinction and reddening to look at the dust content of CGM regions around galaxies. We find a similar evolution where the redshifts overlaps. And of course, there's been many efforts of doing SED fitting to derive the dust mass in galaxies with dedicated surveys, including gamma, that show actually an interesting, I find, turn at the lowest redshift, which I think still needs to be explained. We can compare this to the global dusts expected from the far infrared background that is shown here in pink area. So this is now the global dust content. But I'd like to stress that our measurements allow to probe the highest redshift, where we can put new constraints of models. I'm showing two kinds of hydrodynamical models that have a full incorporation of dust physics, you know, dust production and destruction, and that show similar shapes but very different normalization. So I think with this new data, we can put new constraints on this kind of models. So I'd like to spare a few words to move, you know, from these global quantities to, you know, local galaxy, and in particular, try to understand how we can directly probe these different processes that we've talked about. I think in recent years, there was a very powerful synergy between the absorption techniques that I've described and emission, thanks in particular to 3D spectroscopy, which is essentially imaging where every pixel is a spectrum. So of course, MUSE and VLT and the future BlueMUSE are excellent instruments that allow to look for galaxies that are responsible for the absorbers that I've been talking about. And so that we can relate the metallicity, the kinematics, the geometry of these systems. We can do that for the H1 gas, we can do that for the ionized gas observed with MUSE, but of course we can also do that for the molecular gas observed with ALMA. So here I'm just showing one example of a field where I've removed the quasar in the scale of a plane. This is the white square. And to the left, I'm showing the oxygen-free emission at the redshift of the absorber observed with VLT MUSE. And to the right in the same field is the CO1 to 0 observed with ALMA. And I've cut a narrow band, if you want, into these cubes. And so you have X, Y information, and the depth of the cubes are the wavelength. You see, for example, in news, some of these objects are detected in continuum. In ALMA, they are not. But you see the velocity field, right? The blob in ALMA is stretched, and we can build the molecular gas velocity field in that object. There are several objects in the news cube in particular. And this kind of information can, in some cases, as the one here, tell us about the physical processes I've been talking about. So, for example, here is a reconstructed velocity field in the Muse cube, showing a rotating disks with a blue and red component. So we do a 3D forward modeling using a MCMC chain to reconstruct the velocity field in the gas. And we know the position of the quasar sightline so that we can interpret the profile seen in absorption in velocity space, right? So this is the black dot shows the position of the quasar in the plane of the sky. So we expect at the quasar line of sight, a velocity of the order of 100 kilometers per second that nicely explain this strong component in the magnesium 2 profile here in the bottom spectrum. But the smaller component, blueward of this, is most likely a signature of gas accretion. And we know that because of the orientation of a galaxy along the major axis. We know that because of the metallicity of that component that is lower, and because its angular momentum that is 2 to 3 times higher than the one from the galaxy as expected from this accretion scenario in cosmological simulations. So it's very difficult to find observational evidence of accretion, but I think perhaps using this quasar absorption techniques will enable to do so. So just to draw, you know, the mental picture that I have of such systems is, again, if we focus on the starlight, we see multiple objects. Of course, if we look at the H1 gas, is a lot of low surface brightness gas, you know, in between those objects, maybe remnant of prever merging events or tidal streams. And this gas is very difficult, again, to probe in emission. And if we focus on some of these objects, like M82, then we have a school case example of galactic wind, right? So what we're trying to probe in absorption is this many processes. I guess, ultimately, what we would want is to probe this low-density gas in emission, which is very much, you know, the goal of experiment like Fireball Balloon, that has been led also in Marseille. But also, perhaps some of this could be done with an instrument like BlueMuse on VLT, or ultimately Harmony on the ELT. And I'm showing here some work that we've done with one of Marseille PhD students, Ramona Augustin, to compare how Harmony and VLT instrument compete in terms of surface brightness for this kind of science case. So just to wrap up, I'd like to leave you with some take-home messages. The star formation rate history is driven by a lack of molecular gas at low redshift. And so there's a decrease in the net accretion rate that I think is related to the growth of dark matter halos. We have little evidence today for a so-called missing metals problem, but I think we still have to measure those metals at redshift 1.5, and perhaps, you know, experiments like Hatina will help us making those measurements. And we have performed new calculation of the dust mass density in a uniform way up to the highest redshifts. With this, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Celine, for this amazing journey through metals and dust. Comments and questions. See a lot of participants. I'm sure there's a lot of questions. Feel free to use the chat and unmute yourself. Samuel, please.
Hey. Salut, Celine.
Bonjour.
Thank you for your presentation. Very nice. I have several questions, I guess, so I'm not going to bore everyone with all my questions, but I will ask at least one or two. One comment that I have always is M82 is very unique in the nearby universe. So I guess you imagine that at high redshifts, galaxies are more analog to this one than the more common galaxies that we have at low redshift. And related to that, of course, is a distribution that changed with azimuth of metallicity that you showed. It's very interesting. But of course, metallicity is a relative quantity. So if you were to look, did you look at the actual amount of metals, where are they? Are there more in the outflows, or more in the galaxy, or more in the other places? I don't know. Because, of course, the amount of metals would be the product of metallicity and density. So I was wondering if you looked at that, not just metallicity, but the actual percentage of amount of metals.
So, okay, I see where you're getting at. So let's say that this measurements we've made is the amount of the total amount of metals, so all phases. We've looked at cold gas in particular by essentially applying a temperature cut, which you can think of as a Coulomb density cut. And the result still holds. And so we have not in this work looked at the metal quantity per se, but I mean, there are others that have done that, especially in TNG. You know, looking at, for example, magnesium twos. So this is just cold metals, right? Independent of the mass, as a function of azimuthal angle, among other things. And again, that stays. So the picture I have is, you know, the gas that's falling in along the major axis coming from the cosmic web is not been enriched by metals at all yet. And then, you know, this gas cools down in galaxies, and then stars are being made within galaxy, and that's where the metals are being made in those simulations. And then, you know, there are some of these metals are entrained in this galactic or AGN driven winds. What's interesting, of course, is it's a strong function of stellar mass. What will happen to this gas, right? So some will escape. So the lower mass the galaxy, the lower the potential well, and the easier it is to escape the galaxy. But the more massive objects will retain that gas that will fall back into fountains, right? And that's where it gets very complex. So I do expect that both the metal density, the metallicity, and the metals have a non-uniform distribution with azimuthal angle.
Okay. Can I ask another one, Carlo? It's just something else. You show that the metallicity evolution with the gas, there is no pristine gas, let's say, or very metal poor gas in your case. So that's from absorption, right? And a related question is, did you look at the metallicity in Milky Way stars, which we know has been measured in many cases, and there has been searches for very metal poor stars in the Milky Way. And so I was wondering, and they are rare too, so I was wondering if it's kind of consistent, the distribution of metals you see during the evolution of the universe and the low amount of metal poor or very metal poor stars that we have in the Milky Way.
So I haven't made this direct comparison. That's an interesting point. But I'd like to highlight that this, of course, is a statistical sample. We have, you know, found metal poor gas in some of these DLAs. In fact, it's also one of the goals of the ELTs, including the high-res instruments, is to search for this metal poor gas. But these are targeted system, right? So I was looking at statistical quantities, and indeed these are rare. The frequency, I will have to check whether it's consistent with the Milky Way measurements in stars, but the frequency is low, was my point. We find them, but it's slow. And I think that's an interesting point, because obviously, you know, we have to, at the highest redshift, we need time to make those stars. And we do expect that some of these gas may be pristine. And yet we have a hard time seeing it. I mean, there's very little space in the universe, you know, that is metal poor, and not only those, you know, neutral gas system, but also in the IGM. And I think that's a strong argument for the presence of winds, galactic winds at the highest redshift, because that's the only processes, and that's the processes in any of the hydrodynamical simulations that, you know, expels that expel the metals into outside of galaxies.
Okay, thank you.
We have some of the same topic by Matt, so I'm reverting the order. Please, Matt.
Yeah, thanks. Firstly, thanks very much for the very nice talk, by the way. It's very interesting stuff. Yeah, it's got me thinking about a lot of different things. On this plot in particular, so I guess one comment and maybe further a question. So on this topic, this is the H1 weighted mean. And so this is a mass weighted mean as well, in effect, right? So there is this down weights the majority of the mass is ionized, and the majority of the volume, well, certainly the majority of the volume is ionized. And so that means that we still have a hard time identifying what the metallicity is in much of the ionized gas. So I think a lot of the volume is sort of undefined observationally, at least. Would you disagree with that statement? That's sort of my perspective anyway.
Yeah, I mean, of course you're right. This is very difficult. So what I'm showing here, for example, is metallicity measurements, so H1 weighted metallicity measurement in the form of omega in partially ionized, the so-called sub-DLAs, and in ionized gas in the Lyman limit systems. And the reason why I have only two points in very specific redshift ranges is that we've only taken robust measurements where a full dust depletion and ionization correction, using photoionization modeling, cloudy, were performed, right? And what's interesting is where these redshift overlap, most of the metals are in the neutral gas, actually. So I do not expect that the metals in the more ionized gas dominate.
Yeah, but that's sort of my point, I think, that there is a lot of ionized gas, right? So most of the mass is ionized and most of the volume is not neutral. And therefore, it's mainly a comment. I think this is uncontroversial for you, but it's mainly a comment for everyone else that I think it's easy to interpret what you just said to imply that there are metals everywhere, or indeed that there's very little space, volumetric space, that's not metal enriched. But I think we don't know that because most of the volume is not probed by these metrics. Right. Again, I don't think that's particularly controversial. So going back to your previous plot, onto my question.
Yes.
Yeah. So exactly. So it's interesting to look at these plots because we know that we have to go from pristine to this, right? So again, as you said, there are places where the gas is pristine this H1 weighted mean. So how do we get from these minimum metallicities from somewhere where there's no metals, right? So what is happening that allows us to see to get from pristine gas to sort of jumping to these slightly higher minimum metallicities? I mean, I guess it's partly related to our previous point about having ionized gas becoming enriched and dense and neutral, and you see this.
Yeah, I think we are making stars, right? So essentially, again, this ionized gas, which you're right, dominates, the mass and volume, is further away from galaxies. And the gas, what I call the condensed gas, right, which is, playing a role in as a gas reservoir for making stars, so the atomic plus molecular, takes time to cool down within galaxies, and then there's star formation, increasing with cosmic time, and we're making stars, we're making metals, we're making dust, and this is where, we start to see the metallicity increasing in this neutral gas.
You wouldn't appeal for pre-enrichment at some very early redshift. You're basically, so I mean, where is the 10 to the minus 4 metallicity gas, basically, because it's not in your plot? It must happen sometime, somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, this was pop 3 pre-ionization time, metallicities. So, we will need, very high redshift ALMA measurements, perhaps, to look at these objects. Whether C2 is a good tracer of metals is, not clear because C2 trace both atomic ionized and neutral gas. So, you know, measuring the metallicity of these very high redshift objects is interesting. I mean, James Webb, you know, is going to inform us on this and ultimately the ELTs. But right now, you know, it's very difficult to measure the metallicity of a redshift 8 galaxy.
I guess my impression is that there must be a large amount of mass that's pristine at redshift 2 as well. But both these things must come into play, right?
Yeah, okay. I agree. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
We have two questions more. The first one by Guylaine. Please, Guylaine.
Hello, Céline. I have a question about the discrepancy between your measurement from H1 and the CIB, which is a factor of 5 to 10. So do you understand why it should come from? Or?
Yes. So you're talking about the dust measurement now?
Yeah, sure.
And this is, I think, a different measurement, right? So we're looking again, focusing on the neutral gas in the universe. So we're looking at the dust correction on, the amount of metal locks into dust grains in individual, quasar absorber measurements. We're basing this on elemental empirical techniques developed by Jenkins and DeChia that is making use of Milky Way, SMC, and recently LMC measurements of dust depletion as a function of different elements. Long story short, we're measuring the dust in the cold gas, which I think, you know, going back to this very first picture I have, is saying this is within galaxies. Let me try to click. So we're looking at, you know, the central part of galaxies. The magnesium 2 of Menard and Fukujita argue that they are looking at the outskirts of galaxy, and their measurements are slightly higher than ours. Still unclear to me why there would be more dust in the CGM region than in the center of galaxies. And I guess the CIB, the far infrared background measurements are the total amount of dust, right? And so I expect this to be higher. Now, where is that dust? I'm unclear because, again, as I said to Matt, right, I think that metal production and hence the dust production is taking place in galaxies. So are we ejecting dust?
No. The CIB is only coming from galaxies. There's no CIB in the diffuse IGM. We can account perfectly for the CIB for all the galaxies. There's no contribution from the IGM, so we are looking at the same thing.
It's moving. So that's my point about the neutral gas being central to galaxy.
But the same for CIB, it's really galaxies. Okay, we have never found any signal from the diffuse. Filament or whatever, it's really galaxy. And when we can resolve the CIB into galaxies, the galaxies is making 90% of the CIB at least.
Sure. So I see your point. You know, the galaxy resolved the CIB, right? Is your point?
Yeah.
But if we measure the dust, the mass dust from SED fittings or from quasar absorbers or from magnesium 2, this is shorter. This falls short of the CIB.
Yes, so maybe I have another explanation.
Aha, I'm interested.
I think. So this has been done earlier in the game of modeling the CIB. And for example, we had this kind of model, and with this model, we were overestimating the star formation density at very high redshift. So we have now a new model of CIB that really reconciles everything. So we should use this new model of CIB to compute the dust mass, because the dust mass from CIB is directly a conversion from the luminosity, the emissivity we are observing into the CIB to mass. So we can reduce that again very easily with new models of CIB, and I'm pretty sure it will be much lower.
Right. So you're right. Of course, we are finding that, you know, yes, there are dusty galaxies at high redshift. Maybe they don't play as high a role than we first thought. And indeed, I expect this will change the CIB at higher redshift. In fact, I was going to say this, right? So the mismatch, I think, is between very different way of measuring dust in galaxies, right? So from multi-wavelength SED fitting, to using absorption techniques. And all of these observational results seems to agree. So.
Okay, but if you are interested, this is a project we could do quite easily.
Yeah, I think that would be very interesting to reconcile the two. And then another question I would have to you, Hélène, is why does it turn down at the lowest redshift? You know, why are the total amount of tasks decreasing at the lowest redshift? I mean, we only make dust. I mean, we destroy it at a rate that is not going to overtake the way at which we are producing it.
You mean from the CIB? The decrease from the CIB?
Every measurement shows the same.
I don't know. We can discuss more about that, but for now, I really don't know.
Yes.
I cannot have my mind ready. You know, I'm doing the commissioning of concerto at the same time and looking at Neptune map for now. So I cannot be very useful for any important scientific discussion for now.
Well, I'm very excited about concerto. So please let us know. You know what's happening there. It's a very exciting project.
In the meanwhile, there was a question about Katarina. College, please.
Yes. Hi, Céline. Thank you for an excellent talk. So I was wondering whether there is any observational evidence for the environmental dependence of either the H1 content directly or whatever phase, gas phase you measure. This would be one question, and another one is related. So is there any observational evidence of the dependence of the accretion onto the galaxies with respect to the environment? And I mean large-scale environment, like namely filaments.
Yeah,
and this
kind. Yeah, got you. Yeah, so, okay, that's another very exciting direction, I think. So to first part of your question is, where do we find H1? So remember, it took us 3 decades to identify the counterparts to DLAs, essentially, right? We spent orbits and orbits with HST trying to find those guys and rarely found any. Now with IFUs, we find them in 90% of the cases, right? And to my surprise, we do not find one galaxy, we find multiple galaxies, right? So more often than not, when we pick, you know, a quasar observer based on the unrelated background quasar, we pick a large H1 observer system, and we look at that redshift that we know very well, you know, emitting galaxy, we find multiple galaxies. And some of them are rich in CO, right, as we see from ALMA. So these are picking over density in the universe. And news field of view is not yet big enough to tell us whether there are real groups or not, but there are multiple members. So yes, I think the H1 gas that we are probing in absorption is, you know, broadly speaking, tracing over densities that I believe, you know, is must be related to filaments. Now, the next question, of course, is, you know, how the orientation of galaxy and the accretion process relates to this environment that you are talking about, right? Filaments and cosmic web. And so, of course, you know, there are results both in observations, local observations, saying that, you know, maybe those galaxies align differently depending where they align the filament. And I think this is very exciting work. And I think there's also a way to look at this in, again, in simulations, right? So we are currently looking at magnesium 2 in particular. And so again, tracing, you know, the accretion and outflows in magnesium 2s in TNG. And we're looking at this as a function of environment, so over density, but I think we could also look at this as a function of essentially position in the cosmic web. And I'd be very interested to look at this, because I think, you know, the naive expectation is that these accretion processes are not random, but they are related to the environment, as you say. So I think this is a very interesting avenue to explore in the future.
Yeah, absolutely, especially with the data that you have, because I don't know if you are aware, there were two sort of contradictory results, observational results of the H1 content of galaxies with respect to the filaments. And one work found that the H1 of galaxies increases as they approach to the filaments, and the other one found exactly the opposite. Now, the question is that just the effect of the mass, where the more massive objects are still able to accrete the gas that is flowing through the filaments, while the lower mass objects could be still gas stripped even in those filaments. So I think it's a really interesting question and very open. And if you if your data, if you can do this with your data, it would be super exciting.
Yeah. I think we need a sample, right? So if we had a sample of muse absorption emission objects, we will get the orientation, and you know, we'll find where they lie in you know, their distribution with other numbers, and that would be interesting to look at. I agree. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And even though we are running out of time, never mind. And see a last question on the chat by Samuel.
Oh yeah, but you can reply very quickly if you are fed up. No, you show a lot of results with H1, which is from absorption. And I was thinking now there's going to be SKA, and we will see stuff in emission too, up to intermediate redshift probably. So what are your ideas about that?
This is very exciting, and I think it's starting already with Meerkat and ASCAP. So of course Meerkat is going to more look at the, you know, OH or, you know, other molecular tracers, but ASCAP is you know, with a flash survey that is led by James Allison and Aideen, is you know, targeting H1 observer blindly and finding a lot of them, which we are following up with Muse and ALMA. And so this is going to, I think, answer one pending question we have about this quantity. I said that I think it's well measured, but still there is one issue to my mind, is that a high redshift, this is H1 absorption measurements, and at low redshift, this is 21 centimeter measurements. And we have very little, we have none redshift overlap. So the two techniques don't have a redshift overlap. I think it would be a very important scientific experiment than to use, you know, ASCAP and ultimately SKA to do either individual or stacking H1 search at, you know, medium redshift, where we start to get measurement from absorption, so that, you know, we're sure that those two different techniques can, you know, lead to the same results. But of course, you know, on top of this, we will learn about this atomic gas in great details, and I think those are very interesting prospects. Yeah.
Well, I think that maybe we can stop here, the very long but exciting discussions. The Cafe Club is going to be 1 hour long and not 30 minutes as usual, since sometimes that's I like so much. So thank you, Céline, again. Next week we don't have any Cafe Club scheduled, so we will convene in 2 weeks with a Cafe Club by Luisa Lucy Smith, who will talk from MPA. We'll talk about deep learning insights into cosmology.